paperback only this time around. So we've got a few days before launch day.
So what has happened most recently then to make people take all of this more seriously?
Well, 2023 was actually an incredible year for disclosure of ET contact. Now, for a long time, people have suspected there was something going on at Area 51, for instance. People are thinking there are retrieved craft there, aren't there? We're trying to reverse engineer stuff. But it was all sort of urban legend and only had the attention of sort of conspiracy theorists. But in 2023, a whole load of information relating to that came into the public domain and became part of a stoush between the Pentagon and the US Congress. Now, all of a sudden, in the public domain, we've got information relating to who's been running the reverse engineering program. So we have the names of the people who've run it, the names of the people who've been responsible for blocking disclosure. We know what was retrieved, when and where, and we know the locations, the current locations of entire craft that have been retrieved. Now, if people haven't been watching the story, they might not know that all this was part of a public hearing on July the 26th of last year, and that this information came from 40 witnesses within the military intelligence community who had given sworn testimony to Thomas Monheim, who's the Inspector General of the intelligence community. So all that is now out there. It's been authenticated at the highest levels in terms of military intelligence secrecy clearances. And we've never had that level of disclosure and information in the public domain before. I think really since 1947, the policy has essentially been silence and debunking of any idea that UFOs are real or that we've caught them or we've got materials that we're reverse engineering. And all that changed in 2023.
So what were the most startling revelations to you then from all of that material?
Well, the material wasn't so much of a surprise because if you follow the story, if you've been listening to people like Hamish Shed, the former chief of space security for Israel, or Alain Juillet, the former chief of French intelligence, or people like Ed Mitchell, sixth man to walk on the moon, there were these breadcrumbs of information that really added up to that. And then in 2019, that's when the Pentagon actually went public and said, yes, we have something running called the program. That's our R&D department that's trying to reverse engineer materials we've retrieved from UFO crashes. So all that has been in the public domain. But the fact that this was allowed to escalate into a public conversation between the Pentagon and Congress blew my socks off. And it tells you that the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, Thomas Monheim, and DOPSA, which is the security review of any kind of statement that has to be made by people who've signed all the NDAs and official secrets laws, both those authorities are in a forward-leaning position in terms of letting the public know that we have craft, pilots, non-human biologics. This was the language used in that hearing, which is being examined. But the thing that has really amazed me is that after more than 70 years of official secrecy surrounding this whole topic, we can now hear from the physicists who are working on the reverse engineering. So these are very credible, highly credentialed people, world-renowned physicists like Jacques Vallée. We've got Eric W. Davis, the American physicist. Gary Nolan, interestingly, he's a microbiologist, all working on materials that have been retrieved from UFOs, or what we now call UAPs. And they're allowed to speak publicly about it, and they're allowed to tell us what they're working on, what it is they're trying to create. And the word on the street is that when we see the footage of things like the Tic Tac craft from 2004 being engaged by the USS Nimitz, these craft seem to ping into our airspace as if from nowhere and then zip across the sky and then turn at 90 degrees, do things that we have no idea how to do. And the word on the street is that they're able to do that because of what the craft are made from, and that those materials have an effect on space-time, that they create like a little bubble around them that enables them to manipulate space-time, and so they will dart across the sky in those kinds of ways that so far we've only been able to imagine. But the three people I've just named, it's their job to reverse engineer the bits of that material that we have. Because once we can do that, that's when we really become spacefarers. And I think that's when the rules of the game will change fundamentally.
So if they're allowed to talk about these materials then, do we know the consistency of them? Is it metal? Is there radiation involved? What details have we got about what they're made of?
Some of the details include that the isotopes in these, what they call metamaterials or exotic materials, indicate that they were engineered outside of Earth's atmosphere in zero G. They were engineered in space. And so Eric Davis quotes this phrase in a note of a conversation he had with Admiral Thomas Wilson, who headed up one of the agencies involved in the program. And so that's one detail. They're trying to recreate these isotopes. They're trying to learn to engineer at a subatomic level, which is something new for us. So we know that much. But when we start listening to intelligence agencies of other countries, the whole language of retrievals from UFO crashes, a big question mark suddenly has to be applied to that. Because if we listen to Israel's former chief of space security, when he discusses the program, he talks about collaborations with visitors. And his suggestion is we have hands on their technology, and that some of these crash retrievals are actually materials we've been given. And essentially the challenge is, can you make this yet?
So fascinating. We've all seen sci-fi movies or Twilight Zone episodes, perhaps, where things have fallen from outer space to the Earth, and they've had to be handled very carefully because of some kind of disease spreading to the humans or radiation or something or other. Are these the risks that these people are taking with these materials, and are safety protocols in place to prevent anything from breaking loose across the Earth from these materials?
Yes, well, the question you've just asked was one of the oh my goodness questions that came out in the hearing on July the 26th. And David Grush, who is really the star witness of that hearing, mentioned briefly in passing that, yes, some people have passed away in this technological pursuit. So it was not made clear whether that was due to some tiff or conflict, or that was because of the materials that were being examined. To be fair, I haven't specifically heard anything about the metamaterials having a toxic effect on people. I think touching a live craft, if you listen to the law of the last 70 years, is probably something you don't want to do. And when it comes to the pilots and non-human biologics, to use David Grush's phrase, you might not want to touch them with your bare hands either, because the law is that that can have a physical effect on us that is very difficult to treat.
So, Paul, as an expert on this, do you fear that the possibility of opening Pandora's box through these examinations?
No, I think Pandora's box is already open behind closed doors. I mean, when we have this much information in the public domain, authenticated at the highest levels, you have to wonder how much further forward we are behind closed doors. And anyone can go on YouTube and they can watch that entire hearing and just take note of when the questions reach a point where the witnesses have to say, I can't answer that in public. That'll have to be in a SCIF, a secure comparted information facility. that tells you that really is the key question. And watch this space for any drip drip of information on that. And where it stops tends to be at the most interesting spots. So pilots, oh, are they alive? Well, that will have to be for a skiff. Are we talking about extraterrestrials or a covert presence here? I can't answer that publicly. I mean, all those really juicy questions is where it all goes private. But behind closed doors, there are answers to those questions. Behind closed doors, we're probably further forward technologically than has been revealed in public. And I think that would only be logical. I think, if I were a journalist, and I'm thinking of Ross Coulthard when I say this, because he is a very courageous journalist, my fellow Australian, who really broke this whole story open when David Grush agreed to do an interview with him. If I were Ross Coulthard, I would go to the offices of Boeing, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Skunk Works. These are the aerospace corporations to whom the Pentagon has subcontracted the work of the program. And I'd be asking, how far forward are we behind closed doors? Now, I might not expect an answer because they'll all have signed NDAs, so on and so forth. But if I were a journalist, I'd ask those questions and I'd record the reaction, because you can bet your bottom dollar that more has been done than we've yet been told.
So in the book, Guns, Germs and Steel, it demonstrates that whoever has the advance in military technology gets to dominate the world. So if we can reverse engineer these materials and fly TikToks, surely that would mean that whoever is able to do that first will become the dominant military power. Does that therefore mean we are in an arms race with all of the countries of the world presently who have got their hands on any kinds of materials to reverse engineer them? And is that why there's so much secret hearings surrounding this?
Well, I think let's start with the Tic Tacs that you mentioned. If the USA for one moment thought that, say, China had their hands on that kind of technology, I think their response would be totally different to what we've seen. When we talk about the program, we are talking about the USA/Israeli program. There may be other iterations of it around the world. And Haim Ashed, the brigadier general who for 28 years was Israel's chief of space security, suggested, yes, there are other countries who at a covert government level are in secret collaborations with our visitors. So, yes, you might expect other countries to have a program, but they don't have the trillions of unaccounted for dollars that the Pentagon has had access to over the last more than seven decades to push that forward. And I think probably the USA/Israel are at the sharp end of those conversations and those technological abilities. Now, if it was just an arms race, as you put it, at a terrestrial level, yes, that would be scary. But what Haim Ashed said is that we're at contact at a covert government level and that our visitors are sort of sitting here watching to see when we're going to reach the technological bar to become part of the club. That suggests that there are decisions, because that's when they will self-disclose. That's the punchline to that. So what that suggests is that even at the covert government level, we're not in charge of this process. We're in the mix, but our visitors probably have a little bit more clout as to how all this plays out than anyone you or I would have heard of.
So are you saying...
Personally, I actually find that reassuring in a funny kind of way when I look at our political cadre around the world.
So one would assume then that this would be kept in utmost secrecy until the materials were reverse engineered. So are you saying then that the confidence instilled by the vast resources available to the Pentagon is what's enabled the government to release information presently, without them fearing they're going to get gazumped by a different country?
Oh, yes, yes. I don't think the USA is anxious about being gazumped by another country. I think your logic is quite sound there, that if that anxiety was there, there would be less disclosure happening. But I think disclosure is happening for a couple of reasons. One is that, yes, I think we are getting closer to that technological bar. We've got the materials. We know what it is we have to replicate. We know what those materials have to do. So I think we're getting closer, and so we're getting information that will prepare us. At the same time, I think some information is leaked almost as an insurance against disclosure, so that if some other authority suddenly makes clear we're in contact, we're quite far forward, the USA, their authorities need to be able to say, yes, we already told you this. This information was already out there. And the way they do it is they put the information out there so people become habituated to it. So there's no shock horror, you know, with the great reveal. And this happened, for instance, with the footage of the Tic Tac craft, with the authentication of the program, the reverse engineering program. That information was leaked in 2017. We now know it was a semi-official leak by Chris Mellon, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. And that information just sat there in the public domain for 2 years. So for 2 years, everyone could go on YouTube and watch the videos of the Nimitz encounter and hear unofficial witnesses saying, yes, there's a program to replicate this technology. And then after 2 years, when there'd been no blind panic, and the apocalypse hadn't happened and the sky hadn't fallen, then the Pentagon was able to say, yes, we authenticate that. That's true. And I think that is the pattern. Now we've got all this body of information that came out last year through the hearing. I think they're going to sit with that for a couple of years, and then there'll be an official authentication of that. So there's always just enough information. So there's only a one-step catch-up to say, don't you remember, we've already shared this information and it's not that big a deal. So I think there's disclosure as insurance against, and bearing in mind that if there are other programs around the world, the USA has to be ready for India saying something or China saying something. They can't always control what's happening. And the acceleration of mass sightings in the last few years suggests that the non-disclosure agreement among our visitors might not be quite as watertight as it's been in the past.
So if and when these materials are reverse engineered, do we have some kind of agreement with our visitors that these materials will be used for good as opposed to evil?
Well, if I listen to Hamish Ed, he argues that what is going to change is that we become part of the community of spacefaring civilizations. So we will go from being the visited, the observed, the studied, the abducted, to being part of that club that has access to the cosmos. We can ping into somebody else's airspace. And that's not just building on what Hamish said. Ed Mitchell campaigned for a long time for the US government to come clean about the contact that was already in place and what had happened in terms of the program, because he believed we are on the brink of that change, where we become part of what Hamish called the Galactic Federation, where we have a voice in this exopolitical group that decides what's happening with Project Earth. He saw it as a positive thing with all the knowledge he had that he couldn't reveal because of official secrets laws and NDAs. And he lived through all those decades where secrecy was maintained by death threats from the US military. So it's very significant the things he did say, what he was allowed to say. And all through the decades, he was trying to get people to pay attention to this topic. He was saying, if you're a skeptic, if you don't believe in ETs, if you don't believe we're in contact, the one topic you might want to explore is UFO crash retrievals. And he said this all through his later life. He died in 2016. And then in 2017, we had the unofficial leak. 2019, the authentication of the program. And now we realize, yes, he was really onto something. This is the topic that blows the world of contact open.
So if you yourself were allowed access to these materials, because there are so many unknowns surrounding them, would you feel that you, would you just confidently go in and access them, or would you put up some kind of way of protecting yourself from the unknown? It's so unpredictable, isn't it? What could possibly happen with these materials?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, I think we're probably under quite close observation and, dare I say, control as to our experiments in this area, bearing in mind that this iteration of the program goes back to the 1940s, following a great spat of UFO sightings. And the mass sightings began in the 1940s, as soon as we started detonating nuclear warheads. So after the Trinity test, after Nagasaki, after Hiroshima, that's when all of a sudden we have all this cosmic company that was being observed in mass sightings, being pursued by US military and military around the world. So I think a concern that we don't accidentally blow ourselves to pieces is part of current arrangements. I think our visitors have worked out at how non-adept we might be with technology like that. But personally, I'm less interested in the materials and more interested in the political realities surrounding the program. If we've got visitors who are calling shots in terms of what happens on planet Earth, who are they? That's what I want to know. And who is representing us in these conversations? In whose interests are decisions being made? I have an old-fashioned belief in democracy, that decisions that affect all of us benefit from the light of public scrutiny. How many trillions of unaccounted for dollars can be spent before that becomes public business? I mean, that is public money. And so these are the things that interest me. When I listen to ancestral narratives from around the world, because this is what got me sucked into this whole topic, it was studying the root meanings of keywords in the Bible, realizing there's a whole other story hidden there, a story that's repeated by indigenous cultures around the world. If I go there and they talk about experiences of contact in the deep past, yes, technology is part of the story. Yes, trying to reverse engineer it is part of the story. But they ask very different questions. And they would ask us, are you sure you haven't been annexed? How would you know if you'd been annexed? How would you know if all of a sudden you've got non-human concerns that are driving your politics behind closed doors? And that's what I explore in The Invasion of Eden. I listen to indigenous story around the world where they say, these are the things you need to look out for, and these are the things you need to do in order to protect your sovereignty. And I think it's that more than the technology that really concerns me in 2024.
So David Icke has been talking about this stuff for many years, and people have been laughing at him. Have you looked at the theories of David Icke in relation to this stuff?
David Icke is a fascinating figure. I mean, I remember the interview that he did with Terry Wogan more than 30 years ago, when the audience was laughing at these far out things that this sports presenter was suddenly coming out with. If you go and look at that recording now on YouTube, he sounds a whole lot less radical than he did at the time. And now that we know there is a program of reverse engineering, a whole chunk of what he was saying gets authenticated. If you listen to ancestral narratives and they talk about non-human interests defining human politics, well, David Icke was talking about that decades ago. And it's just amazing to me how mainstream David Icke is becoming without really changing his tune. Now, I should say, en route, he has said some pretty far out things that would raise the hair on the back of most people's necks. But there are many things that we laughed at 30 years ago that I think we would take far more seriously now. I think the idea of covert government is not news to most people. The idea that the people we elect are not the ones who make the most important decisions, that we have to go into the corporate world. And I mean, you don't have to listen to David Icke. You can go back to the 1600s and listen to Robert Kirk, who wrote the book, The Secret Commonwealth. He, like me, was a Bible translator. He, like me, listened to Indigenous story, although not around the world. He just listened to Indigenous story in Scotland. And he concluded on the basis of his research that until you recognize there's a non-human layer to the management of Project Earth, you won't understand why things work in the way they do, why there is a machinization of human society, why there is this push for urbanization, just to go back to what Austin Williams was saying. And this is happening in Australia. Australia, I can talk about. I live here. I've lived here for 25 years. And through all the changes from one democratically elected government to the next, there's been an Uber policy of withdrawing resources from the regions so that human populations can be concentrated into major urban areas where they can be better managed. Well, if I listen to ancestral story from Hawaii or from the Levant, they would say that's one of the signs. If you're seeing an escalation of means of control, an escalation of dependency of the public on the state, that's something that should raise some red flags. And in many ways, all around the world, we see those kinds of trends where more and more we're dependent on working for those who issue money and all sorts of regulations coming year after year to make it harder to be self-sufficient, harder to work for yourself, harder to live off the land. I mean, in Australia, you're not even allowed to use the rainwater beyond a certain volume that falls on your own land, because that's the state's rainwater. And our ancestors would say, when you look at the machinization of society, escalations of means of control, this is an old, old story that tells you that the authorities making decisions have no fellow feeling with human beings. And that's the sort of thing we should be looking out for.
And your research has traced it back to Genesis.
It's there in Genesis too. That's right. So, I mean, you can go to Babylon and hear the story of Oannes and the Apkallu, and everything I've just said is in that story. You can go to the Hawaiian story of the Mo'o, and everything I've just said is in that story. But I got into this by discovering this story in the pages of Genesis, in the stories of the Elohim, in the stories of Yahweh, Chemosh, Dagon, Asherah, all these mystifying figures washing around in the text. And I learned that when you go to the root meanings of the key words, the familiar translations don't appear. God Almighty doesn't exist. The Lord Almighty doesn't exist. The word most commonly translated as God doesn't mean that. It means the powerful ones. Texts that have been interpreted as spiritual texts turn out to be technological texts. We've got explanations of weapons of mass destruction that can ethnically cleanse entire districts. You can find that in the book of Ezekiel, for instance, in the book of Job. We've got physical descriptions of entities governing over humans, and they are not human descriptions, different kind of skin. They've got feathers. They've got reptilian features, just to go back to what David Icke was saying. And funnily enough, when I was listening to David Icke perhaps 20 years ago and he started using reptilian language, I thought, wait a minute, that's in the book of Job. That's in Psalms. That's in 1 and 2 Kings. That's in Jeremiah. And I realized that there is this story there, along with a suppression of the memory of what Judaism was in the beginning. Because in the beginning, it was a memory of paleo contact, contact with all kinds of entities, who were summarized by the phrase, the Tzeva Hashemayim, the sky armies. And as I say, their weaponry is described, their craft are described in the book of Exodus. Translators have tried to interpret it as spiritual phenomena, but you and I, who have seen weapons of mass destruction, who have seen rocket launches, will recognize it in the texts when we read it. And that's why I argue that a fresh translation of these ancient texts is really long overdue.
So why was there a suppression from the Christian writing in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD?
Well, the suppression begins earlier, really, in the 6th century BCE is when the Old Testament took its current form. And the Bible actually tells you the story of that editing and redaction. It talks about a king, Hezekiah, who worshipped Yahweh. Now, Yahweh was one of the Tzeva HaShemayim, one of the beings in the sky armies, one among many. And the clue is there in the Ten Commandments when Yahweh says, I don't want you serving any of the other powerful ones. That's right at the beginning of the Ten Commandments. And so the reader should ask, other powerful ones, who are they? No, don't remember them. Don't even draw them, he says. Don't depict them. Or in the book of Joshua, he says, decide who you're going to work for. You're going to work for the powerful ones of the Egyptians, the powerful ones of our ancestors in Mesopotamia. As for me and my house, we're going to serve Yahweh. So he's one of a number. But this king, Hezekiah, worshipped him. Because he worshipped a violent entity, it really justified any violence he would use as king in the name of that entity. So it was a convenient entity to choose. And he decided his whole nation should worship the same God that he did. And so he went around, or his forces did, his armies went around, demolishing the temples to these other entities, commemorating these other beings. Now, these had been set up by the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah. Solomon, their most famous, wisest king, had built a temple to Yahweh. He'd also built a temple to Asherah and shrines to Chemosh and Milcom and these other entities. Hezekiah said, demolish them, disband those priesthoods, and I want my army to go into the Jerusalem temple and deface that carving showing what the Tzeva HaShemayim looked like. There's also a physical depiction of what Yahweh looked like. Get rid of that, because if people saw that, they wouldn't worship him either. So that's where the reform starts. King Hezekiah, the royal scribe Shaphan, the high priest Hilkiah, and then Hezekiah's grandson Josiah adds to the ritual reforms, which is what those were sort of politely called, to a scriptural reform, where there was an editing of all the scriptures that Jewish people conventionally read, so that it now looks like a story of God from beginning to end. And so their holy name for God, Yahweh, gets pasted over all these earlier texts to make it look like a story of God. So Yahweh is the one who does the terraforming. Yahweh is the one who looks after human beings. Yahweh is the one who does all the rescue. But the fact that he competes with other powerful beings is still in the text. The fact that he's one of the junior Elohim is given away in the book of Deuteronomy and in the book of Psalms, because other Elohim get land and people. He only gets a people group with no land. So the first time we meet the Yahweh character, he has to go onto somebody else's land, Akek of Egypt, and extract his people group. And then they have to fight for land because Yahweh didn't get given any. So the shape of the stories themselves tells you this isn't a God story. When the people sack Yahweh because they don't like the way he's been governing, that's a little clue. They're not talking about the Lord God Almighty, because you can hardly sack him and replace him with a human. So the stories are all there. And the way the changes have been made, the author is really showing you in plain sight how the stories have been changed, what they are now, and what they were in the beginning. And in the invasion of Eden, I go back to what they were in the beginning. And I ask the question, what did our ancestors want us to know about contact? Did they say we should be afraid of it? Are there goodies and baddies in the world of alien visitors? And how do we do diplomacy to ensure that it's a happy future for the human race and not an unhappy one?
So do you suspect then at the very least that the Vatican has knowledge of all this, or more likely that over the centuries they have got their hands on materials and possibly alien corpses?
Well, just like the USA and Israel and the other countries hinted at by Hamish Shedd, I believe the Vatican has its own reverse engineering program. So I think in its vaults, it has not only ancient texts, it's got bits and pieces that have been retrieved from around the world. And, I mean, there are many layers to every war. But, for instance, when we went into Iraq in 2003, through my contact with veterans of that war, I know we were there for many reasons. And one of them was to retrieve artifacts that the military intelligence community were concerned might give some kind of strategic advantage to an enemy if they got hold of them. Artifacts are retrieved in every invasion, conquest, colonization, and the Vatican has been at the heart of colonizations through the centuries. So you think about the invasions of Central and South America. I believe there were artifacts retrieved from there. They would now be in the vaults of the kings of Spain, Portugal, and the Vatican, along with all the ancient texts giving explanation as to what those artifacts were. And we know there was a massive book burning that happened with the conquest of Central and South America. And the volumes that were not burned would be in those secret places. So I think there's a lot of interesting information in the halls of the Vatican. And it may be for that reason that the Vatican has actually been one of the most forward-leaning sovereign authorities leaking disclosure information. Back in 2009, the Vatican was saying we should be ready for ET contact and we shouldn't be surprised by ET contact because it's in the Bible. And it was that that really got my attention. And I thought, really? Could I have missed something as obvious as aliens in the Bible? Is that possible? And I went back, I did my own study, going to the root meanings of the key words, and I realized, yes, it's not just a smattering. It's from cover to cover. The paleocontact stories of the Bible are unavoidable once you go into the Hebrew and the Greek and ask, what do these words mean?
So if the ancient stories were co-opted then, to give a narrative that suited the Christians of the time, wouldn't that narrative unravel if the Vatican confirmed or released what they know? Or are the different factions in the Vatican factions that want this information out there, but others that want to stick to the narrative that was put in motion after it was all co-opted?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, in 2009, when the Roman Catholic Church had its colloquium, this public symposium of top theologians and scholars discussing the implications of contact, their answer was, no, this doesn't unravel anything. It just means the Creator's been busier than we thought. because they didn't want people to panic and they didn't want people suddenly to buy out of Roman Catholicism because now there's this off-syllabus information that's turned up. That was what they wanted the message to be. Personally, I think it does unravel a little bit more than that. I think as soon as you start thinking about God in a more cosmic way, some of our silly tribalisms and manipulations and uses of religion as a means of control, I think those do unravel. And I think they should unravel because in those aspects, religion has been a tremendously, powerfully awful force in world history. It is behind enslavements of whole people groups, the conquest of other people's countries, all kinds of misogyny, auto de fe, not sure if I can say this word, but if you follow the story of the Cathars and find out that a million people were killed on papal instructions over 19 successive papal administrations in the 1200s, these are all aspects of religion we could do well without. And I think that kind of tribalism and authoritarianism and crusading does begin to disintegrate when you realize that our little theological world has missed out some of the most important facts, if indeed we're living in a populated cosmos, if indeed we're part of a cosmic family, and if the ancestral stories that our crusading evangelist ancestors tried to stamp out, if those stories are true, then we are a lot more closely related to our cosmic companions than we might think. Our origin stories are totally different. I've discovered when you go back to the origin stories in the Bible, God doesn't figure in them. So I think a lot more unravels than perhaps the Vatican wanted to indicate. Having said that, I'm very comfortable with the language of God. I understand it very differently to how I did a few years ago. I'm very comfortable taking seriously the teachings of Jesus. I understand them very differently to how I did a few years ago. And for me, there's been quite a process of sort of unlearning and reframing. And it's not an easy thing to think your way through. So having experienced that as an individual, I know that it's something the churches are going to struggle with, but they're going to have to catch up. After the 2023 that we had last year, the churches are so behind on equipping the faithful to deal with the fact that we're in contact. They are in danger of losing a lot of people and losing a lot of credibility, as are other authorities, of course. I mean, if all of a sudden we realize our elected governments have not been in control in the way we hope they might be, I mean, there's a lot of fallout that could potentially come from this. I think the drip of disclosure is an attempt to avoid massive fallout, but I think there's a lot of rethinking we have to do.
So the old man in the sky then, do you think that there was something in the sky originally that was then transformed into the old man in the sky, and that thing originally could have been an alien in the sky?
Well, if we go back to the 6th century BC and back to that edit, the short answer to that question is yes. I believe the Yahweh character that was venerated by King Hezekiah was one of a number of ET visitors. And I think that's where our old man in the sky concept has come from Hezekiah's religion that became later Judaism that morphed into Christianity. I think it's a really unhelpful way to think of God, because if there is an old man in the sky permitting all the pain and suffering that we see around the world, I mean, you only just have to turn on the news to have an idea of what I'm talking about. Look at some footage and ask what kind of old man in the sky would allow that, would think that that's all right, or would create a world where that can play out. There's no way you can make that old man in the sky a good guy. And I think it's time that we move beyond that idea and ask, what is really going on? What is the nature of our power in this? Because, I mean, there's a lot of suffering on planet Earth that is simply down to how we behave. What is our potential? Can we generate a better society than this? It's another reason why I love ancestral narratives, because they all say, yes, we can, but you really do have to shake off old paradigms of venerating superiors, old paradigms of social control. We really do have to discover one another in a peer-to-peer kind of way, in a fresh way, if we're going to chart a better way forward. And there's all sorts of information like that in the Bible available to us once we peel back the layers of old man in the sky story and realize that our ancestors were on about something quite different.
So, Paul, how do you see this playing out? What's the best case scenario and what's the worst?
I think for me, having looked into this, the worst case scenario is that we stick with decisions that were made behind closed doors in the 1940s in the Truman administration. I think that's when the current collaborations and compacts were made, because I don't think they will serve us well moving forward. I think we've got more company now than we had in the 1940s. I think we need to be doing very careful diplomacy to see that we are in conversation with the company that can help us the most, that is most concerned about humanity. The best case scenario for me is that there is more public scrutiny on the program and on those political machinations. I think as long as this is done in secrecy behind closed doors, that is a recipe for the worst kind of decision making. So for me, the best case scenario is that Boeing, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Skunk Works succeed in reverse engineering those materials, make that public, and now all of a sudden we're having a conversation about how do we move forward. Now we've got free energy. Now we've got access to the cosmos. Now we're in conversation with civilizations more advanced than our own. That's when there's the potential for humanity's next great leap forward, because we've had leaps forward in the past into agronomy, into science, into civics, into city building, civilization building. I want one of those, not an annexation. And so best case scenario is more disclosure, more accountability, and decisions made in the interest in all of us, not in the interests of the 1% of the 1%.
Well, Paul, absolutely fascinating, just like last time. Thank you for your time. And can you please let the viewers know where they can get your book and find you and support you?
Absolutely. Invasion of Eden is the next book out on April the 9th. You can go to Amazon and find it there. Go to paulanthonywallace.com. That's my website. You can find me on YouTube, on The Fifth Kind and the Paul Wallace channel. And our website is fifthkind.tv.
All right. Really appreciate you spending time and have a great rest of your day. Cheers.
Thanks, Sean. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Paul.